This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. According to the National Low Income Housing Coalition, the Orlando-Kissimmee-Sanford area has the fourth lowest availability nationwide of rental housing for low or extremely low income households. In other words, it's hard to find a place to live for those families. This month, the president of the Orlando Regional Realtors Association, Lou Nimkov, said the lack of affordable housing is a real concern. Orange County leaders say the solution lies in building partnerships with other counties and the private sector to build more inclusive communities with housing for a wide variety of income levels. An upcoming workshop will focus on regulations and incentives to promote the development of affordable housing. Last May, I sat down with Mayor Jacobs, Housing and Community Development Manager Mitchell Glasser, and Orange County Planner Alberto Vargas to talk more about how to provide affordable housing.
I think for a lot of people, they're probably maybe a little surprised that affordable housing is a major issue of concern for us. Just a few years back, we had this nearly complete collapse of the housing market. And here today, we're already, just a few short years later, finding that we are one of the leading states and leading regions in the country for the lack of affordable housing for many of our workforce. So we've got a couple of things. We are doing a regional work group that's working with our staff from Seminole, Osceola County, as well as the City of Orlando, to look at large-scale changes in how we approve affordable housing, where affordable housing should go. But we're also working on several pilot projects, if you will, some innovative approaches. One of them is a market-based approach, and I'm going to turn to Mitchell Glasser, who's here from our Housing Development Department, and he's going to talk a little bit about one of the projects that he has originally come forward with just in the last maybe year, and how that's going.
So the project that we've been involved with is called Golden Point Apartments, and it's a new affordable housing subdivision that is on Goldenrod Road, just south of University Boulevard. And Orange County provided a couple million dollars of invest funds that we used in conjunction with some private and public funds to create not just your typical affordable housing project, but the unique model of this project is that 20% of the units were set aside for homeless families. And it's a low-barrier entry unit for those homeless families, so they could actually move in with no security deposit, no application fee. The only background check will be a criminal background check. So it's an opportunity to allow homeless families to reestablish themselves into a housing market, into an affordable complex. And after 1 year, they will graduate into another affordable unit within the complex, and those units will rotate every year, so we will be serving another 20% of the complex of homeless families. It's a 70-unit apartment complex, and 14 of those units are set aside for homeless families.
I mean, is that enough? Because the homeless problem in Central Florida is pretty huge. Like, that's a kind of a drop in the bucket, really, isn't it?
Right. So this is a new construction project, and it's taking an affordable housing development, and it's building in affordable units within the complex. So it's a model that we're trying to pilot model that we're trying to bring forth to the market and show the private sector and the governments that how you can build into your development affordable units, homeless units that look the same, the clientele will look the same, and build that into the infrastructure. In addition to this, the mayor has a lot of initiatives on rapid rehousing, working with the Homeless Services Network. And the county has put into $1 million of funds to help people actually locate apartments within the private sector as a whole and give rental assistance. So they're addressing homelessness on a number of fronts. This is just a project that is demonstrating how you can address it with new construction.
So let me address one of the questions that you asked. Excellent question in terms of the scale and the magnitude of the problem that we are trying to face here for families, especially that are unable to find housing, working families, or families that were working and are unable to because they've lost their home or their apartment. The scale that we're talking about, obviously, you're correct, is not anywhere close to what we need. What we are looking at is pilot programs, pilot strategies to see what may have the most effectiveness, the least number of dollars to subsidize, and the best outcomes. But on a broader scale, because the magnitude of the problem is significant, in fact, it's a nationwide problem. We definitely have about twice the propensity of lack of affordable housing that most counties and regions our size. Nonetheless, it's a national problem. So,
can I just interrupt? Can I ask you, like, what do you think is the reason for that? Like, why is Orange County in this unique position of having a bigger problem than other parts of the country?
I think there's several reasons. I would, on the supply side, in terms of the availability of apartments, I think part of it is the lack of enough apartments, and the demand. We saw an increase in demand for apartments after the collapse of the housing market. A lot of people that were in houses that they couldn't afford, that have then moved out of their houses, moved into apartments. That has increased tremendously demand for apartments without the corresponding increase in supply. So part of it is just a supply-demand, a lack of equilibrium that we're currently experiencing. Part of it is the fact that we have so many people moving to this community that the marketplace, the builders that are building apartments, can choose to build higher-end apartments and make more money. And, of course, that's what the market will do. So that's where we find that the public sector is having to intervene. And there's several strategies to intervening. This particular approach is one approach. It's something that Mitchell developed, and we're testing that to see how effective that is. But throughout the region, there are a lot of different approaches being used. Well, in order to deal with this on a more comprehensive and a broader scale, we are also doing a series of, we've done a summit on affordable housing strategies, and we're doing a series of three workshops. That's being led by Alberto Vargas, who's here with us today, and he can talk a little bit about what we're trying to accomplish with that. The goal is for us to get the three counties, the largest cities, and then hopefully the rest of the cities within the Tri-County region to support the same types of strategies so that we can encourage, incentivize, or require the development community to build the capacity that we need to house the population that we have. I will give you one other reason why I think that we're seeing this problem and why we have such a large number of homeless families here in our community, and that is that we are there's a theory called destination homelessness. And the theory goes that there are certain communities that become targets for homelessness based on their climate. If you're going to be homeless, where would be a better place to be homeless, in Chicago or in Orlando? The climate is much more conducive. Then there is also the issue of opportunity for jobs. And we are well known as having a low unemployment, with the very rare exception that we had during the recession. Low unemployment and the expectation that you can come here and find a low-skilled job. These things are true. We have low unemployment, just over 4%, and we do have low-skilled jobs that people expect. They can come here, they can find a job if they've lost a job someplace else. What most people that come here expecting to find a job don't realize is that the cost of living here has become out of reach for many people in those low-skilled, low-wage jobs. So I think that we have a combination of several things going on. The supply-demand disconnect, the fact that there isn't the motivation for developers to build in the lower cost spectrum. And then thirdly, this influx of people coming here, leaving other places, believing they can find a job and make a living here.
Let me ask you, Alberto, so if you're talking about trying to get the private sector involved, how keen are they to get involved in these mixed-use or mixed affordability developments where you have a range of apartments for different ranges of income levels?
A couple of angles to that specific question. One of the things that we have been able to determine from the get-go, and it has been very important to set the foundation to realize that this is a challenge that has to be tackled with the private sector as a partner. This is not a local government solution alone. It needs to be tackled with the development community. And in order to do that, what we're moving forward with after the summit, after all of the issues were framed, the challenge has been identified, is the fact that we need to better understand the areas that are suitable for future infill and redevelopment with the missing component that we are questioning at this particular time, which is attainable housing or affordable housing. And that is critical. You know, what are those specific areas, and how do we go about finding out the right formula, indicators that begin to reveal suitability, which is basically proximity to transit. So transit corridors are ripe for highlighted areas, proximity to services as well, and jobs, and so that you begin to remove the cost of transportation out of the equation from future families. The other, and Mayor Jacobs just alluded to that, which is how we're growing. And we're growing at a rate of 2%. When we look at a 25-year projection, we're looking at over 600,000 people coming to Orange County. With the first workshop, we're going to be identifying all of the indicators that become a model of identifying map-based areas for all of these specific implementation strategies to become ripe for that future dialogue with the development community.
Mayor Jacobs, I want to ask you real quick, if I could, about federal funding and how that fits into all this, because there has been talk of, you know, cutting the budget for the Department of Housing and Urban Development. Wondering what your thoughts are on that, like potential budget cuts and what kind of impact that could have on Orange County's housing.
I'm extremely concerned about it, and not just from Orange County's standpoint, because as I mentioned before, this is a problem that is not an Orange County problem. It's not a state of Florida problem. It is a national problem. There's not a state in the union where a citizen making minimum wage can afford a one-bedroom apartment. So there's varying degrees of the problem, but it's a nationwide problem, which means we need nationwide solutions. And so it's not just about the fact that we need those HUD dollars to support the housing for our local citizens, but it means everybody needs to have their fair share so that people that are living in a community can afford to live and work and stay in that community, not uproot their family trying to figure out who may have enough money to create the economic incentives that might be necessary. And the economic incentives are quite significant, and I think more than you can expect any community to individually bear. So if it's not dealt with through national policies, then it at least needs to be addressed through national funding. I think these issues, things like the heroin epidemic, others that are national problems, have to have national federal support.
And does it have a knock-on effect to state funding? I was looking at the proposed state budget. It includes taking some money out of what I understand is called the Sadowski Fund for affordable housing. What do you think of that idea?
Always concerned about that. We have fought for so many years to try to keep the Sadowski funds, the trust funds, specifically used for their intended purpose. It's been an ongoing battle. When I hear about, we like to use the term raiding the fund. When I hear about that, I grow very concerned. I know that there are a lot of needs. I sit here as the mayor of Orange County, and our budget process is about balancing those needs. I get that. I'm not foreign to that. I'm not naive about it. But I know how important affordable housing is to the state of Florida. It's fundamental to the state of Florida to make sure that the people who work here can afford to live here. Without that, the entire economic model falls apart. So I think it's extremely important. We have made all of our legislative delegation aware of how important this is to us.
Mitchell, what do you think the biggest challenges for the next 12 months, 24 months?
Well, as Alberto mentioned, we've embarked on a regional process, and we're going to be looking at all the tools that are available to help us drive our policies, drive our codes, encourage the private sector to, you know, basically joint venture with us to build more inclusive communities. And by inclusive communities, I mean communities that have variety of housing types, variety of incomes, and affordable housing as a part of that picture.
You know, there was a time, and it wasn't very long ago, when the practice was to try to concentrate everyone who was in the affordable housing category into one development. Many of us remember the days when there were literally projects where the less wealthy, let's say that as diplomatically as I can, lived together. And what we're attempting to accomplish here, and what we will accomplish here, is a mixed housing where families of different walks of life, of different economic backgrounds and abilities, are living together. It creates a much more positive environment. It's not just culturally what we believe we should be doing. It's not segregating out those who don't make as much. That's not only not healthy socially, but it's not healthy from an economic standpoint as well. So the types of developments we're talking about are very attractive developments, but it's making sure that a certain portion of those are affordable and that the children that grow up in those developments feel that they have all of the same opportunities and role models and examples of success. That's extremely important to a child. What they see around them starts to tell them who they can become. And we want to make sure that our children here in Orange County see all sorts of people with all sorts of careers and opportunities so that they can decide and strive for. Children can accomplish almost anything if they believe they can. But a big part of that for children that live in environments where they don't see that opportunity is that they don't ever see the potential that is within them.
That sounds great, but is it realistic? Do you see this coming to pass? Is this going to come true, this vision of people living together from all walks of life and every economic strata?
Yeah, absolutely. Believe it or not, I do, because we're making that happen. We're making that happen because this is the way we are developing things, and that's what you see happening at Lyft. You see it happening in Orlando. You see it happening here. Yeah, because that's the commitment that we've made. And is it hard? Is it different for people? Yeah. But it's not... But it's like so many things that you're not used to. There's things that we're not used to are scary. We tend to be creatures of habit, and we're scared of the unknown, and we're scared of people that we haven't been around. I don't know why that is the nature of people, but it just seems to be a human tendency. And yet, almost always when you get to know people, you find out that in the end, there's very little that separates us and makes us different. There's much more that makes us the same. So I think from a cultural standpoint, there's an enormous amount to be gained. It's one of the reasons that I'm such a huge believer of public schools. My kids have all gone to public schools, and there might have been times when I thought they could have gotten maybe a little bit better academic education, but I never could have replaced what they got in terms of the real-world understanding that we all come from different walks of life, but we're the same inside, and we have the same drives. That's a fundamental part of creating a strong society, and that's more important than all the other stuff here we talk about.
Yeah, Teresa Jacobs, thanks for your time.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thanks to Mitchell Glasser.
Thank you.
Thank you to Alberto Vargas.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you.
That conversation first aired on Intersection last May. Still to come, this is not your average internship. Jet dragsters can hit speeds of 280 miles per hour, and it's up to the Florida Tech interns with Larson Motorsports to keep the drivers safe when they're hurtling down the track. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. From the Education Desk this week on Intersection, we revisit a conversation with the founder of Larson Motorsports and two interns at a drag racing team, driver in training Kat Redner, who's studying journalism at the Florida Institute of Technology, and pit crew chief Paige Sanchez, who has a master's degree in mechanical engineering and is working on a PhD in aviation sciences. Elaine, I want to start with you. Just explain what a jet dragster is and how fast can you get it to go?
Okay, so this is like a landlocked missile. This car goes 0 to 100 in 1 second, 0 to 280 miles an hour in only 5.5 seconds. We use a jet engine, a General Electric J85 out of a T-38, a little fighter trainer that we put on this landlocked missile, and it is so much fun. My job goes a quarter mile at a time at 280 miles an hour.
How far is a course for one of these races?
So the actual drag strip is only 1,320 feet, and then I usually get about twice that to be able to stop. I have to use a custom cross-form parachute to be able to stop this car in a very short distance.
So just explain what it's like getting into the driver's seat of one of these and going that fast. Is there any comparison to it?
There sure isn't. You know, I think that a lot of people, you could maybe kind of say it's like on a roller coaster, only you're in control. You know, you always get those butterflies when you get into the car. I'm restrained by 12 points of restraint. There's a lot of engineering and human factors that kind of goes into this driver's compartment, my office. And you fire this thing up and you just point and aim it and hope for the best at the end of the racetrack.
So as far as controlling it, it's basically just making sure it's going in a straight line?
Absolutely. This car is thrust driven. The engine's going to produce about 5,000 pounds of thrust. We use a custom afterburner that we build at our shop. And if you point it straight, she's probably going to go that way. Now, there's always variations. If there's a crosswind or, you know, a bump in the track or something like that, if you have to steer out of it. But pretty much it's point and aim and shut her off on time.
Okay, let me bring you into this conversation, Kat Redner. What's it like being a driver in training? It sounds quite exciting.
So being a driver in training, it's a bit nerve-wracking because I've never driven a race car before. The fastest thing I've driven was a V6 Mustang before I got into a jet car. So it was definitely an experience. Getting in, it's always, you have to calm yourself down when you get in the car, and then you just focus on that finish line and the point to stop. And when the parachute comes out, it's just pure relief.
So how much practice do you have to do before they actually say, okay, you're good to go, we're going to put you in the car by yourself and you can take control?
So we have to do quite a bit of practice. Chris Larson, Elaine's husband, actually does a training course for a few days, so you get to know all about the jet car. After that, Elaine gets you in the car, has you start it up and make some fire. Then you do engine only, so you take it to the track, and then it's all on you. And engine only is a little bit slower. Well, it's a lot slower than lighting the afterburner. So it just gets you into the ease of driving the car and making sure you know what you're doing before you light the afterburner, which creates a lot more power and has you go a lot faster. So after you do the engine only, you do the afterburner, and you go about 280.
What was it like for you the first time you switched on that afterburner? You said it was a bit nerve-wracking being a driver in training. What was kind of going through your head just before you fired that thing up?
What was going through my head was probably just focusing on the point to shut off the car. I was just focusing on that finish line, and I pulled the parachute and throttle back, and the parachutes came out, and it was a great feeling.
And when you let those parachutes go, is it a slow sort of roll out, or is it a bit bumpy?
It's a pretty big bump, but I like it because you know that parachute is stopping you, and it's relieving to feel that.
So are you looking at this as a career, or is it just a, you know, part of the degree you're doing?
I am actually looking at this as a career because I love going to the racetrack, meeting fans, seeing all the different people, and it's just a lot of fun getting to teach little kids about STEAM and STEM education with what we do with the jet dragsters, because there's so much of that and what we do there.
Okay, so Paige Sanchez, you're also part of the program at Florida Institute of Technology with Larson Motorsports. Tell me about what goes into being a crew chief for a drag racing team.
Being a crew chief for Larson Motorsports is no simple task. I basically have Elaine's life in my hands. When I tighten those nuts and bolts on the race car, it's going to go 280 miles an hour, and her safety is all up to me. So I'm responsible for the pre- and post-race inspections on the car. I'm responsible for all the equipment at the track, which includes the truck and the trailer and the vehicle. And then back at the shop, we have to be or pay so much attention to detail. So we tear apart these cars, inspect it inch by inch to make sure everything is race ready. So it's a pretty huge job.
And you'd have to know quite a bit about jet engines too, right? So it's not just your average race car. There's something a little special about this one.
Right. I'm a mechanical engineer, so I didn't exactly learn jet engines in college. But the one great thing about our team is we have so many people on our team that have specialization. So I might not have to know every single thing on the car to be a crew chief. My main focus is more structurally. That's what I went to school for. But we have people on the shop that make this team go. So we have people at the shop that work on the engines, that work on the chassis, fabrication, paintwork. So I feel like we all have a pretty big hand in each of these race cars.
How much variation can there be in a drag racing car? And Elaine, this might be something you can weigh in on as well. Like, how many sort of modifications can you make to the vehicle before you're kind of in a different category or something?
So in a jet car, there's a lot of different fine tuning that you can get. You know, I'm a girl and I like diamonds, but in my jet car, I love shock diamonds. And what that means is the gases contract and expand when they go through the engine as they come out the afterburner, and you can see these little rings. So what Paige has to do is she has to control the fuel, the air that's getting into the engine, and being able to harness all that power that's going through the engine. So she really takes in effect of the elevation, you know, the humidity, the weather, the atmosphere, and then she gives me the best tuned car that she can and tells me what I need to do to get down the track.
Paige, let me come back to you for a moment. I understand you've been interested in racing for quite some time and also pursuing a career in engineering. What's it like now being able to put those two things together and put the theory into action?
Honestly, it's a dream come true. I never thought I would be in drag racing, especially jet drag racing. I was always a huge NASCAR fan growing up, and I always wanted to be a race engineer for a NASCAR team. But then when I got to college, Larson Motorsports was right down the street, and little did I know that I would be an IHRA Jet Car World Championship with the Lane Larson. And so to be only in my early 20s and to have a championship under my belt working with the best in the business, I can't even put this into words. One huge thing about Larson Motorsports is mentoring the younger generation. So as soon as I stepped in there, I literally had no hands-on experience. I was always a straight-A student that knew the math and the science, but when it came to race cars and actually working on them, I had pretty much zero knowledge. So coming into the shop, they taught me everything I need to know from the ground up, from welding to working with tools to fabrication, you name it. And they pretty much taught me everything that I know about the race car.
How's it been working with those other folks in the team? Are they happy to have a student and sort of help mentor you and show you the ropes?
Yeah, definitely. I feel like that's one thing that Larson Motorsports really prides ourselves on. Is this mentorship program. It is so rewarding for both the mentor and the mentee, and I feel like we're all learning along the way. And I think having students in the shop really gives that engineering perspective. So Larson Motorsports, they're a race team. We don't have engineers working on the race team. We're technicians. And so to have that engineering perspective, doing the modeling, doing the analysis, it really sheds a whole new light in what we do out on the racetrack.
You were talking about responsibility just before. You're talking about the responsibility, making sure that, you know, the car's functioning well and obviously your driver is safe. But what about winning? You're also thinking about how the team is doing. Does that put a little bit of pressure on you as well?
Yeah, absolutely. What we do is the real deal. It's not a collegiate competition that we're trying to win in one little competition. This is throughout the course of a year. This is throughout the course of multiple years. So what we're doing, we're competing with the big dogs in the industry, and that's a lot of pressure. We have everyone looking at us, especially being women in the industry. So it definitely adds some pressure, but I think the best part about it is that it is real, and we are working with these people that have been racing their entire lives, and it's really humbling to be a small college student in such a huge sport, and that I get to play a small part in it.
Elaine Larson, tell me about what got you involved or interested in drag racing from the get-go, because you've been doing this for like 20 years now.
I sure have. What got me started was the husband, man. He loved things that went fast. He has the aerospace background. He's a pilot. He's a mechanic. He's an engineer. He's a little bit of everything. And he brought me into his world of going fast in these high performance vehicles. So 25 years ago, I hopped in a race car and never looked back and always wanted to go faster. About, 7 years ago, I ended up hitting a wall at 280 miles an hour. And, you know, as racing enthusiasts, we always look at these wrecks differently. When you're a fan, you're like, wow, look at the big fire. But when you're a team or a driver or a crew, it's a whole different perspective. And I think what I love best about our team is that we looked at things differently. And that's what brought us here to Florida Institute of Technology. They're a full-on research university. They're looking at foam implementation. They're looking at driver's compartment. You know, how do we keep our drivers safer? And we come up with a real-world problem. We take it to Florida Tech, and they research it and come back and give us their thoughts. So we're taking what we do into a whole next generation and bringing this next generation in here to hopefully be better, safer, faster. And Kat's looking to kick my butt, I'm sure, but she's going to have to work really hard because Paige and I, we've got the winning champ two times in a row. So I've taught her everything that I know except maybe one or two tricks.
Elaine Larson, how do you walk away from a 280-mile-an-hour crash with a rocket strapped onto the back of your car? That sounds like a tricky proposition.
It sure is. You know, in the good times, everything are good. But when things go bad, it's amazing how quickly everything can unfold. And luckily, we had engineered a really safe driver's compartment, and I did walk away. I ended up with a subdural hematoma, a head injury, which Paige, my crew chief, really took serious. She looked at, you know, where I got hurt, what made me get hurt, and how could she make me safer. So not only does she crew my car on the weekends, during the week, she looks at how she can make my car safer. And she does a lot of research on that, from foam to extra chassis around me or, you know, whatever it's going to take. I got back in the car because I have the best of the best behind me. I have Florida Tech doing all the research. I have my husband who leads a great team at Larson Motorsports. And I have my crew chief, man. Paige keeps me safe. She gave me a safe race car to get down the track every single time.
Did it take you a while to get back into racing mode, though? I'm just wondering if there's a bit of trepidation, you know, the next time you set out to race, knowing you had that crash in your rearview mirror.
You know, when I was in the hospital, I knew I had some choices to make. And I'm sitting here the first day, I'm thinking I'm never going to get back. But I literally raced to eat. Okay, so this is how I make my living, is racing. And the first day I said, oh, no, I'm done. Second day, I thought, you know, it might not be so bad. But by the third day, I'm saying, where's my fire suit? So literally 6 weeks after I got out of the hospital, I was back in the car and I've never looked back. It is way harder, though, putting a young girl like Kat. Kat Renner's only 20 years old. I'm putting this young girl in this race car knowing what it could potentially do to her. And that's way scarier than what the race car could ever do to me. You know, I love these kids just like they're my own. And, you know, it's tough to know that you've trained them with the knowledge, but are they going to have the ability to get that car safe and sound down the track?
Let me ask too about the other drivers. Like, how many women drivers are there in this business?
In jet racing, there's probably only about six or seven of us. There's not that many. In racing in general, especially drag racing, there's quite a few more. There's a small handful, 50, 60 that are in the pro game. Hundreds more in the sportsman level. I think that women have been coming up through the ranks, not only in driving, but Paige is, like, she's blazing new trails being a crew chief. That's the part that I love. You know, as a driver, we get all the fame, the fortune, hopefully, and we get all the TV time. But for me, I'm only the person who holds the steering wheel. I couldn't even get my car to the track by myself. I couldn't even get my car started by myself. My crew means everything to me. They start from the day they come up with the concept of the design. They start from when they bend that first piece of chromoly around me. And, you know, they're the real heroes. I just kind of make them look good if I get the car down the racetrack.
So what are you hoping that this will lead to? Do you want to see more drivers, more women behind the wheel of these jet drag races? Do you want to see more crew chiefs like Paige?
You know, what I hope is that it plants a seed. I hope that it plants a seed that will grow to make these young next generation kids to say, you know, if Elaine, Kat, and Paige can do this, what can I do? Whether that path leads them into jet racing, rockets, I mean, you know, we're launching things in space all the time. I want them to push their boundaries. I want them to think outside the box and, you know, go for their passion and know that nothing can stop them except their own fear. If you have the guts, you can go for the glory. And that's what I hope. I'd love to have them all come to my shop and come to Florida Tech and, you know, be the next jet racing, you know, spectacular person. But, you know, if their path leads them in a different direction, that's awesome. Just to know that we potentially had a part in that.
Well, Elaine Larson, drag racer, co-founder and president of Larson Motorsports, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us. This is a dream to be able to give back to this, you know, Paige and Kat. And, you know, you have to follow us on our social media sites and stuff because we do a lot of really fun stuff. We're going to be out racing real soon and hopefully at a track near you guys.
Paige Sanchez, she's a crew chief. She's also a Florida Tech student. Thank you so much, Paige.
Yes, thank you so much. It was a joy to be here.
And Kat Redner, driver in training with Larson Motorsports and also Florida Institute of Technology student. Thank you so much, Kat.
Thank you for having us.
That interview first aired on Intersection last November. Still to come, from the drag racing pit to the virtual ringside, a glimpse into the business of esports. If you missed an episode of Intersection, check out our website, wmfe.org/intersection. Find us on the NPR One app or download the podcast from iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back in a minute. This is Intersection, I'm Matthew Petty. Esports, competitive video gaming, draws big crowds. For more on the world of esports, we're going to revisit a conversation that first aired on Intersection last May. Well, joining us in the studio is Alex Jabaley. He's with CEO Gaming. Thank you so much, Alex.
Thank you.
Also, Ben Knoll. He's the Executive Director of the Florida Interactive Entertainment Academy at the University of Central Florida. Thank you so much, Ben.
Great to be here.
Alex, start us off. What's your elevator pitch to somebody who has no idea what it is you do? What do you tell them?
Usually in my age range, it's, do you have any kids that play video games, for one? Just generally, you know, it's a hobby, first and foremost, but it's a very fastly, rapidly growing hobby that a lot of people are enjoying. A lot of developers that make these games have these communities that are so dedicated and passionate about what they make that it just keeps growing and getting more eyes on it. So usually my pitch to them is... It's just like watching any sport on TV. You have the players, you have the crowd, you have the interactions between the players and the crowd. And so it's just something that's very easy to latch on to once you understand what's going on.
And there's quite a bit of money involved in these competitions now.
It ranges all over the place. Fighting game community, it's still growing. Last year, one of the biggest prize pots ever was for Street Fighter V. A Tampa player named Knuckledew won. He ended up getting a check for about $240,000. For fighting games. There's also team-based games like Dota, called the International, one of the biggest in the world. I think the first place team of four or five players got about like $5 million split among them. So it continues to grow. Now you're seeing a lot of NBA teams sponsoring their own teams in the esports world. And the main reason I've discovered is because the same demographic that would watch these video games are also watching sports or playing basketball, stuff like that. So it goes hand in hand with everything that you're seeing on TV now.
Ben Knoll, you've been in charge of the Florida Interactive Entertainment Academy since 2005. Just how far has interactive entertainment and gaming come since then?
Well, it's, you know, it was starting to become mainstream. That's why, you know, kids started looking at graduate schools and developers started looking at universities instead of just recruiting from one another. And so the evolution from console gaming, PC gaming, to the handheld world, to the mobile world, to the cell phone, smartphone world, to, you know, like what we're talking about today, you know, e-leagues and e-sports.
Mm-hmm.
It's all an evolution. And, you know, the evolution of the e-sports is just the beginning. You know, I mean, what is it? It's 300 to 500 million or so, you know, as far as right now, but continuing to grow, and, you know, as far as the revenues. That's where it's all driven by, the revenues and the advertising. And eventually you'll see wagering. And when you start seeing the leagues, you know, mature into, you know, testing for PEDs and really monitoring the players and stuff.
Just break this down for our listeners. PEDs, you mean like
performance enhancing drugs, just like other sports that are big money, you know, football, basketball, baseball, you know, MMA. When they first got started, nobody was looking at it. They were just seeing, and the top comes off, and then they say, okay, this is going to be long term. We're going to regulate it. And there's wagering on all that. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the models of the future of Las Vegas, you know, there's still going to be obviously the traditional games. But as far as sports and betting and performance, you're going to see the electronic sports right alongside the live action.
How did you get involved in what you do now?
Oh, gosh. I was doing building rooms like the one we're sitting in sometimes, anechoic chambers and EMC stuff in Austin, Texas. And Electronic Arts was looking to start moving into something called an online world, like massively multiplayer online world. And that was pretty exciting to me. So I took over a vice president's position to help organize Origin Systems back in the day. And, you know, Ultima Online to EverQuest to World of Warcraft to E-Leagues and all of this, and the community-based stuff, you know. Alex was right, you know, a lot of the commentators are coming from, just like sports, they come from the prior sports and the ones that are more professional and can help promote it and, you know, really, you know, have a vested interest in it.
Do you play some of these games yourself, or did you play?
Well, in my day, I've played, and I play with my kids now. The E-Leagues are kind of fun to watch. We're involved in a little of those, so it's always exciting to be in a different business model. So, yes, we can always all go back and, you know, play the Wii, go back and even some of us, you know, might have an Atari, or at least we have some systems that we can.
Do you have one in your garage?
We have it's at home or at Fire. We have lots of things with lots of emulators and stuff, so we have pretty much all the games. The kids, like I said, you know, Nintendo makes great stuff, so it moves from platform to platform to platform, those franchises. So the Zeldas, yes, enjoy playing those with my kids and stuff like that. But it's really exciting to see the new business of online, because it just gets out of sight, out from just being a developer's world to a marketing world, and then all the cross-promotion that's going on now. And the ability, you know, we have kids coming into the program, so, you know, we're excited again because of this. We have, you know, the NBA, you know, the Orlando Magic have a team, you know, it's going to have an E-League this year. And, you know, they're going to have a draft and a combine, and they're going to, all the players are going to move to their respective cities and be under contract. And, you know, that's a different management model. And it's very interesting because we have a lot of young people coming into the to our program that aren't just looking to be hardcore programmers or the designer or, you know, a 3D artist. They're looking to get into more of the project management and the design and the evolution of you know, different business models.
And you were talking about the potential for gambling down the track. I mean, what happens now? Making wages, for example.
Well, you know, different countries, you know, we're talking about this now, but, you know, Korea and South Korea has just been going on for years and years. When we, you know, when we went to South Korea, it was like, wow, broadband was everywhere. And so that drove a lot of this. And the, you know, they have wagering and they have bigger pots of money and stuff like that over there. And they got huge crowds and followings. And, you know, we're a little different society over here. We've grown up in our living rooms, not game rooms. They grew up in game rooms, so they really transitioned to the arena type environment.
And is a game room kind of like a stadium? Like, what exactly is it?
A game room is anywhere from, you know, 5 or 6 computers, and you're selling, you know, chips and soda to...
Like a LAN center as well.
Yeah, okay. Like a LAN, or to, you know, in the malls in Korea, there'll be 200 seats, and everybody's playing, you know, StarCraft. And it's, you know, decked out, it's your arcade. But they, you know, in South Korea, you think about, you know, how many people live in Seoul. They don't have the living room with the setup that we have. They have very small quarters with six or seven people living in. They go downstairs to the ground floor of one of the malls for their game rooms. It's easy to take those community-based, large scale. They were very good at these type of fighting games and taking it to the arena. And now we're just kind of piggybacking off of that.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. We're talking to Ben Knoll from the Florida Interactive Entertainment Academy and Alex Jabaley with CEO Gaming. Alex, do you see the kind of thing that Ben's talking about taking off here, like big gaming rooms with hundreds of seats?
To add real quick to the whole marketing and crossover, back in the 90s when I was in arcade, you know, going to the arcades playing Mortal Kombat, you can never interact with the developers, the Ed Boons, one of the co-creators of Mortal Kombat. Now, fast forward 20 years later, because of the whole social media boom, they sponsor my event. I'm on a, you know, talking basis with these developers that make these games, and they listen more than ever to the feedback of the community, and that's how these games are getting better and more interactive with the community. They're understanding the community's wants, the needs. Back then, tournaments were always run by the community and stuff. Now you have Twitch.tv doing a big push because, you know, they were bought out by Amazon last year, which was a really big deal. People are watching more Twitch.tv than cable TV now in some sports. And back to what he's saying, it's continuing to grow. When it comes to online infrastructures, like he's saying, a lot of people are at home on their computer by themselves connecting to the online world. Our internet's still not at that level of a Japan or South Korea for the internet tournaments to really be successful. They have been growing. You get, for example, there's some fighting game tournaments like a Street Fighter Online tournament will have probably about 500 entrants or so, but you're still going to have that network connectivity where some players have a laggy connection or they can't connect to each other. So that's why the live tournaments are still such a big deal, and you have these huge tournaments popping up all over the place, getting people to come and compete And the difference between a fighting game world and the, you know, the major esports world like a League of Legends or Dota, those are mostly inviting the top players. You're qualifying online from home, and then you go to this event as more of a spectator sport.
Mm-hmm.
The beauty of fighting games is anybody can just walk in and compete on that same day of the tournament, and then within 24 hours, boom, you're down to the finals. So this, on all aspects, is growing. Like we were saying earlier, NBA teams are buying up stuff. NFL is getting involved. There's the Madden series with EA, I'm sure he's very aware of. And it's just, you know, we got to see where it is, because right now the big thing is the word esports. You can throw that word out to a company and they go, big money, more people coming.
Mm-hmm.
But really, what is it going to be in 5 years from now? It just really depends on who the innovators are, which developers are going to be like sticking to it for the long haul, not just coming in and going, all right, let's market this game. And once it's done, let's move on to the next game, you know, stuff like that.
Ben, could you have predicted the popularity of the kinds of online gaming we're talking about now 10 years ago?
Absolutely. I think it probably came a little slower than we thought.
Mm-hmm.
When I got into the business in the late 90s, I immediately was looking at the online world as a utility. And so now all of a sudden we have a utility company attached to our development. What can you do? And so it moved a little slower due to sometimes we had economic downturns. We had the internet bubble burst.
Mm-hmm.
We had people like Blizzard who came with World of Warcraft, but it took them about 7 years to get there. And so we were all waiting. But it was no doubt that it was going to the online world and the ability to communicate and the ability to create content on your own is only going to increase.
So who's enrolling in the course you offer? You talked a little bit about the fact that you're now getting people more interested in the business side of things, but is there like a generic student, or does it attract all kinds of people?
First of all, you have to love games. Everybody that enters the program loves games. It's a limited access program, so they apply four times a year. We take roughly half of the applicants that have gone through the process. And they'll come, and about a third of them come from computer science schools,
mm-hmm.
so undergraduate computer science from UCF and all places around the state and around the world, international students, many in programming. And then we have artists. About a third of them are artists, and they come from traditional art schools, but they're all, you know, geared towards the game or movie or CG business. And then we have producers. And producers come from all over, sometimes from computer science and art, but they'll come from digital media, film. They'll come from the classics of business, English, creative writing, English majors and business majors.
And where do they go? Where do your students end up?
Well, that's the great difference in, you know, the way we market ourselves and sell ourselves is, you know, we benchmark, you know, on average starting salaries and where do you go. And so our students, they graduate, and we have, you know, 80 to 90% of our students placed within 6 months in the industry they want, and the average mm-hmm. starting salaries are in, you know, 63,000, 65,000. So that's where we wanted to be. Definitely we're successful because we're placing those students, and they're going to places like locally, they're going to Electronic Arts, Iron Galaxies, you know, Lockheed Martins of the world, Particle City. They're also going, you know, some of them are going back to DICE, which is a studio of Electronic Arts in Sweden, and they're from Sweden, or many of them are going out to California to LucasArts or Disney or other Electronic Arts or Activision studios.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ben Knoll is the Executive Director of Florida Interactive Entertainment Academy at the University of Central Florida. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Also joined by Alex Jabaley. He's the Director of CEO Fighting Games Tournaments. Thanks so much, Alex.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
That conversation first aired on Intersection last May. Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Education reporting on 90.7 is supported by Helios Education Foundation. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. The executive producer is Catherine Welch. Find us online at wmfe.org/intersection. Download the podcast from iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can find us on the NPR One app. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.